Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, DNA Tests, Expert Testimony, and the Confrontation Clause Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 18, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Williams v. Illinois. The issue in this case was whether a defendant's Confrontation Clause rights were violated when an expert witness for the prosecution testified at trial about the results of a DNA test in which the expert witness had not been involved, and which had been performed by an out-of-state analyst who was not present at the trial. The Supreme Court of Illinois found no violation of the Confrontation Clause. By a vote of 5-4, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the state Supreme Court's judgment. Justice Alito, joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy and Breyer, agreed that the admission of expert testimony about the DNA test results did not violate the Confrontation Clause because they considered the testimony either not hearsay or not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. Justice Thomas concurred in the judgment, agreeing that there is no Confrontation Clause violation, but only because he deemed the statement at issue not to be testimonial. Justice Breyer filed a separate concurring opinion. Justice Kagan filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Scalia, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor. To discuss the case, we have John O'Quinn, who is a partner at Kirkland & Ellis, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. O'Quinn.
In Williams v. Illinois, the Supreme Court decided the latest Confrontation Clause case, following from its landmark decision in Crawford v. Washington. In Williams, the Illinois state courts had held that an expert testifying about a DNA profile she matched to a profile produced by an outside laboratory, Cellmark, was not a Confrontation Clause violation, even though the defendant did not have the opportunity to cross-examine those from Cellmark who produced the report. The United States Supreme Court affirmed 5-4 in a highly fractured decision that produced no controlling opinion at all, and unfortunately provides little guidance for the treatment of forensic evidence going forward. The case principally serves to illustrate that the High Court is continuing to struggle with the ramifications of Crawford. The case does, however, also demonstrate that the Supreme Court can sharply divide in ways that do not line up along traditional conservative or liberal axes. In this case, Justices Alito, Kennedy, and the Chief Justice were joined by Justice Breyer, while Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor were joined by Justice Scalia. Justice Thomas charted his own course, providing the deciding vote to affirm, though in so doing he agreed more with the dissent than the plurality along the way. To give some background, the petitioner, Sandy Williams, was convicted after a bench trial of abducting and sexually assaulting the victim, identified as L.J. After the assault, L.J.'s mother called the police, and she was taken to an emergency room where doctors conducted an exam and took DNA evidence, which was sealed in a criminal evidence collection kit, along with a sample of her blood. The samples were later sent to the state crime lab for testing and analysis, which in turn sent them to Cellmark Diagnostic Laboratory for DNA analysis. Cellmark returned the samples to the state crime lab with a male DNA profile. Sandy Williams was later arrested for an unrelated offense, and a blood sample was taken pursuant to a court order. His blood was determined by computer to match that of the male DNA profile taken from the sample collected from the victim. The state's expert then separately reviewed the DNA profile determined by Cellmark and the blood sample taken from Williams and concluded that they were a match. At trial, the state's expert testified that the DNA profile determined by Cellmark from the sample collected from the victim was a match with the DNA of the blood sample taken from Williams because the probability of the same DNA profile occurring in unrelated individuals was over 1 in 8 quadrillion. Cellmark's report itself was never admitted into evidence, and no one from Cellmark ever testified to confirm that the DNA profile it had developed had in fact come from the DNA sample taken from the victim. On cross-examination, the expert conceded that she did not perform the testing on the DNA evidence taken from the victim and that she based her expert conclusion on Cellmark's testing. Williams objected to the evidence regarding testing done by Cellmark as violating the Confrontation Clause and moved to strike expert testimony that was based on the data received from Cellmark. The trial court rejected that argument. Following his conviction, the Illinois Court of Appeals and the state Supreme Court both affirmed. Those courts reasoned that the Cellmark data had not itself been admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, which is all Crawford would prohibit, but instead had been admitted for the limited purpose of explaining the basis of the expert's opinion. They rejected the argument that the expert had merely served as a conduit for introducing other prohibited evidence, but found instead that she had used her own expertise to compare the sample provided by Cellmark and the blood sample taken from Williams. Four justices of the United States Supreme Court agreed. Justice Alito, writing for a plurality, though in reality a minority of the court, since Justice Thomas agreed with the dissenters on this point, would have held that because expert testimony based on hearsay is a firmly rooted exception to the hearsay rule, it thus presents no confrontation clause problem at all. In the plurality's view, the Cellmark report wasn't offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and that should be the end of the issue. This was no different than an expert being offered a hypothetical question, namely to assume that the DNA profile developed by Cellmark was the defendant's. The plurality also put great weight on the fact that this case had been a bench trial and not a jury trial, and that is a distinction that will no doubt be cited in many future cases. The plurality further reasoned that even if the report was offered for the truth of the matter asserted, it was still not a confrontation clause violation because it was not testimonial evidence. The plurality found that there was no prospect of fabrication, that the report's primary purpose was to capture a rapist still at large, not to obtain evidence for use in a conviction, and that it was unknown at the time the report was developed whether it would be inculpatory or exculpatory as to any particular defendant. The plurality is openly skeptical of Crawford's progeny, and Justice Breyer filed a concurrence noting that he continues to hold his dissenting views in Bullcoming and Melendez-Diaz. Justice Breyer was quite explicit in citing policy concerns and the obstacles that an overly aggressive reading of the Confrontation Clause could present for prosecutors wishing to rely on DNA evidence, evidence that by his estimation is far more reliable than other sources such as eyewitness identification. Simply put, Justice Breyer expressed a faith in experts and technicians that sounds good in theory, but perhaps not in practice, and which both Justice Thomas and the dissenters strongly resisted. In his concurrence in the judgment, Justice Thomas rejected the notion that the Cellmark report was used for anything other than to prove the truth of the matter asserted. In his view, shared by five members of the court, himself and four dissenters, in evaluating the expert's opinion, the fact finder must necessarily consider the truth of the Cellmark report. Simply put, absent the Cellmark report, the expert's testimony was utterly irrelevant. While disagreeing with each of the rationales offered by the plurality, Justice Thomas ultimately voted to affirm because he found that the Cellmark report was not testimonial evidence. He would only treat as testimonial statements, quote, bearing indicia of solemnity, end quote, like deposition testimony, prior testimony, or formalized dialogue such as custodial interrogation. Justice Thomas distinguished the materials at issue in earlier forensic evidence cases, specifically Bullcoming and Melendez-Diaz, as essentially being affidavits or certified statements, whereas the report here was not. As the dissent points out, however, this is surely a thin leaf on which to rest application of the Confrontation Clause. The upshot is to exclude what should be more reliable evidence, evidence that is backed by a sworn oath. And the dissent points out that the prosecution can manipulate the Confrontation Clause by choosing simply not to have someone certify their results. Regardless, in Justice Thomas's view, the Confrontation Clause serves to protect against a very specific and limited abuse, being accused with sworn testimony that you have no opportunity to challenge, and does not serve to ensure reliability in all instances. Justice Kagan authored a dissent that is witty, poignant, and at times biting in its critique of both the plurality and the concurrence. She notes at the outset that the, quote, plurality is a plurality in name only, but that it in fact represents a dissenting view because, quote, five justices specifically reject every aspect of its reasoning and every paragraph of its explication, end quote. Likewise, she concludes her dissent, noting that the decision leaves significant confusion in its wake. Quote, what comes out of four justices' desire to limit Melendez-Diaz and Bullcoming in whatever way possible, combined with one justice view of those holdings, is, to be frank, who knows what? Those decisions apparently no longer mean all that they say, yet no one can tell in what way or to what extent they are altered because no proposed limitation commands the support of a majority, end quote. The dissent highlights the power of cross-examination, pointing to a case in California a few years ago where a Cellmark technician realized during cross-examination that she had switched up the victim and accused samples and thus had made an erroneous match. That revelation wouldn't have happened, Justice Kagan suggests, if the report had come in without the opportunity to confront the technician. Justice Kagan thus rejects the notion that it matters whether the lab technician had motivation or even an opportunity to frame the accused, noting that the typical problem with laboratory analyses and the typical focus of cross-examination has to do with careless or incompetent work, not personal vendettas. As she put it, quote, scientific testing is technical to be sure, but it is only as reliable as the people who perform it. That is why a defendant may wish to ask an analyst a variety of questions. How much experience do you have? Have you made mistakes in the past? Did you test the right sample? Did you use the right procedures? And so forth. Turning to Justice Thomas's concurrence, the dissent finds the features of the evidence at issue in Bullcoming and Melendez-Diaz to be indistinguishable from the Cellmark report. Moreover, the dissent also finds the reliance on solemnity to turn the Confrontation Clause on its head. It allows less reliable statements to be used, whereas more reliable ones are constitutionally excluded simply because somebody swore they were true. In some respects, the various opinions that this case has produced simply talk past each other. There are several points of agreement between the plurality and Justice Thomas that go unacknowledged. And Justice Breyer's separate concurrence illustrates that he and Justice Thomas share a common understanding of the evil the Confrontation Clause was meant to address. But that's where the agreement generally ends. The differing approaches of the justices who voted to affirm the decision will lead to unpredictable outcomes. The plurality would allow evidence that Justice Thomas would not, and vice versa. One gets the feeling that in adopting the solemnity limitation, Justice Thomas may have looked long and hard at the ramifications of Crawford and decided that he simply couldn't go that far. In the end, the dissenters chart the clearest, perhaps most principled path, but one that would almost surely be unworkable in an era of modern, complex scientific evidence, which seems quite removed from the concerns that the Confrontation Clause was initially intended to address. DNA and other forensic evidence does not present the kind of he said, she said, sworn accusational testimony with no opportunity for a defendant to confront it. To be sure, as the dissent rightly points out, cross-examination provides a valuable opportunity to ferret out mistakes and errors, and thus is a tremendously useful tool. But it is not the only tool in a defendant's arsenal, and it's far from clear that simply ferreting out mistakes was the principal purpose of the Confrontation Clause. What is clear, however, is that the court will continue to struggle with this issue in cases to come, with Williams providing grist for future arguments by prosecutors and defendants alike.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.